This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, May 27th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Children's Hospital Colorado has declared a pediatric mental health state of emergency. We'll hear why. It's Emerald Ash Borer Awareness Week, and we'll hear from two members of the Colorado Response Team. Then it's Make Them Hear You, a weekly commentary from Chris Moore. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. Then it's a public affair. Today, Tish Buford discusses hope, perseverance, and redemption with Reverend Monica Jackson. Coming up at 9, it's the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. This morning, we'll hear from Fort Collins author Jim Davidson about his latest book, Next Everest. Then at 9:30, a mix of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. First, we'll start with headlines. Here's Ross Brown.
In what Boulder County public health officials said would be the last COVID-19 virtual update for the foreseeable future, information was shared Wednesday about workplace vaccine clinics. Officials emphasized that businesses can still require mask use and continued to encourage people to get inoculated against the coronavirus. Boulder County Public Health Acting Executive Director Lexi Nolan said there's been a decline in daily coronavirus case numbers, noting the average daily numbers per 100,000 people in the past 7 days has dropped to 4.1. At the same time, Boulder County has had 71% of its eligible population vaccinated with at least one dose. Public health data also shows that about 60% of the county's population has received a full course of the vaccination. Colorado's largest school district has a new superintendent. KGNU Steve Miller says the bilingual New Yorker will assume the top position after the former DPS superintendent resigned last November.
The Denver School Board has chosen Alex Marrero, a school district administrator from suburban New York, to lead Denver Public Schools as it recovers from the pandemic. Marrero, 38, served as interim superintendent of the city school district of New Rochelle for the past 8 months after the previous superintendent resigned. He was previously the assistant superintendent in curriculum and instruction in New Rochelle, and before that, an assistant superintendent in East Ramapo, New York. Currently, Marrero and the 7-member board are in contract negotiations. The board is expected to vote on the hire June 3rd. Marrero was chosen from among 3 finalists. The other 2 were Andre Wright, the chief academic officer from Aurora Public Schools, and Stephanie Sullivan, an assistant superintendent at the Brevard Public Schools in Florida. Manero was an English language learner as a child and was born to a Cuban refugee and an immigrant from the Dominican Republic. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Legislation to create a state-backed health insurance plan is one step closer to the Colorado governor's desk after the state Senate on Wednesday passed a bill that includes several amendments added to placate insurance groups, doctors, and others who have reservations about the bill. The Senate voted mostly along party lines, and the bill will now go back to the House for concurrence with amendments. The Colorado option, as it's called, would create new health insurance plans to be offered on the individual and small group markets. It would not directly affect employer-provided insurance. Denver is convening a new public safety working group to review and determine next steps based on recommendations from its task force to reimagine policing and public safety. The task force provided 112 final recommendations to transform Denver's public safety model that were endorsed by a diverse group of community members, as well as more than 40 local organizations and nonprofits. Denver City Council President Stacey Gilmore said the goal is to reframe public safety from an anti-racist lens. The meetings will be open to the public. Gilmore said the working group would partner with the Office of Social Justice and Innovation to help evaluate and dismantle racism within Denver's institutional and structural government systems, policies, and practices. Warmer weather and increased snowmelt and runoff will likely mean Barker Reservoir at the top of Boulder Canyon near Nederland will start spilling as early as this Friday, increasing flows on Boulder Creek. The annual event means residents should use caution near the creek during the high flow period, which may last for several weeks. The Barker spill typically occurs between mid-May to late June, with the exact date dependent on the weather, snowpack, and early spring reservoir levels. Barker Reservoir has relatively limited storage space, and that means when the reservoir is full, snowmelt passes over the spillway and continues downstream into Boulder Creek. And as the spring gardening season gets into full swing, groups fighting to save bees and other pollinators are asking nurseries and consumers to avoid plants grown with harmful pesticides. Some pesticides are sprayed on, but others are systemic and poison the nectar. Sharon Salvaggio with the Xerces Society says gardeners may end up harming the pollinators they're trying to protect, so they need to ask questions before they buy.
What we want is for people to go to their nursery and say, I want plants that are free of pesticides that might harm pollinators.
Xerces has published a tip sheet for consumers on what to ask and another for nurseries on how to offer bee-safe plants. More than a quarter of all North American bumblebees are nearing extinction, and the Western monarch butterfly population has plunged more than 99% since the 1980s, a situation experts blame on pesticide use, climate change, and destruction of habitat. In the weather today, sunny skies and a high around 73 degrees, low tonight 45, warmer tomorrow with a high of 78. But enjoy the beautiful weather now because rain is back in the forecast Saturday through Monday. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
Pediatric healthcare professionals in Colorado are ringing alarm bells about what they say is a crisis in the mental health of the state's children. The Colorado chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics is publicly joining Children's Hospital Colorado in its declaration of a state of emergency for pediatric mental health. Jenna Hausman, Chief Executive Officer of Children's Hospital, says it's been devastating to see suicide become the leading cause of death for children in the state.
My hope in declaring this pediatric mental health state of emergency is that the state of Colorado, our community partners, and all of us can come together with a different level of priority focus and a different level of resources to address this crisis. The frustrating truth is that our schools, our counties, and our healthcare providers across our state have really been taking extraordinary and in some cases even heroic action to create workarounds to a system in our state that simply cannot handle the volume nor the acuity of demand that we are facing.
The demand for acute behavioral health services has nearly doubled across the Children's Hospital system since 2019.
And there have been many weeks in 2021 where the number one reason for presenting to our emergency department is a suicide attempt.
David Brumbaugh, Chief Medical Officer for Children's Colorado, says in more than 20 years in practice, he's never seen anything like the level of demand for pediatric mental health services like in the last 15 months, and that it's only grown more acute in the last 3 months. The weight of this crisis was apparent during a media call with medical caregivers, including Dr. Brumbaugh, speaking about what they've been treating inside under-resourced facilities.
Our kids have run out of resilience. Their tank is empty. And that's where we are right now as a system and as a state. And it's impacting families across our metro area, across our state. And I'm sorry, but this is what we're feeling as caregivers every day. So as a result of this, we're seeing kids who were largely functional, who the kind of floor is falling out from them. They're attempting suicide. They're populating our emergency departments. And on any given morning across our system, we have a dozen or two dozen kids waiting for an inpatient behavioral bed that they may wait hours to days to have access to. And this has stressed our system from the EMS providers that go to the house all the way to our psychiatrists who care for these patients when they come in. And it's really a tough time.
Emergency providers in hospitals are witnessing the most acute manifestations of the pediatric mental health crisis, treating children as young as 8 who have acted on suicidal thoughts.
The state that we are in is not sustainable. This is a situation, like David mentioned, unlike any other that we've experienced, most of us in our career. Some of us have been in healthcare for more than 35 years.
That's Chief Nursing Officer at Children's Colorado, Pat Givens.
We can't build enough beds to keep pace with the demand. We just can't. And so in the meantime, we are in a crisis mode regarding the behavioral health needs of children that we serve, in addition to focusing on and anticipating the normal seasonal illnesses that are common to children and wondering what's going to happen with SARS-CoV-2 next generation and all the variants related to that. We're used to managing staffing and resources to do this work on a routine basis. But now we have this additional surge of children with mental health needs.
Practitioner after practitioner on the call described an ever-worsening wave of depression, anxiety, and trauma among kids, and the lack of a comprehensive mental health infrastructure to intervene before behavioral issues and suicide attempts send children to the hospital. Child psychologist Dr. Jenna Glover gave her insight as to why the situation seems to be getting worse, even as the weight of the pandemic seems to be lifting.
Despite things getting better in terms of COVID, kids have dealt with chronic stress for the past year that has interrupted their development in education, their social development. And so this stress on top of these delays, now kids are asked to be starting back into life again. And many of them feel behind and completely unprepared to be able to go back to regular functioning, which is making them feel completely overwhelmed. During COVID, a lot of my patients talked about at least their teachers are having grace and understanding that things are difficult right now. Many of them feel now they have to just re-engage in life and they don't have the resources to do that. They're burnt out and they feel so behind, they don't know how to catch up. So there's this sense of hopelessness. And we know that hopelessness is the number one predictor of suicidal ideation and suicide attempts. So that's probably why we're seeing this crisis emerge in this way, despite things getting better with COVID.
Glover says demand for pediatric mental health treatment is outstripping the supply of resources and personnel, which can itself create serious social problems in the long term.
I think my largest concern is with the influx of mental health problems that we're seeing and the demand on the system, kids will not get the treatment they need and they will have chronic mental health problems for years that will impact their opportunities in life. So that's my number one concern. I think most problematic, what is happening is that kids are coping primarily through substance use, through withdrawing, and through disordered eating behaviors.
In their declaration of a pediatric mental health state of emergency, Children's Hospital Colorado was asking for a large-scale response. Here's Heidi Baskfield, the hospital's vice president for population health and advocacy.
We are asking for the kind of support where we have the state engage with us as partners in treating this crisis in the way that it can, bringing the resources it has to bear to support all of us working in this space, using tools like executive orders and public health orders to empower those to work together, to do things like create patient transfer centers to manage current need and capacity, and to think about solutions like tapping into our American Rescue Plan Act dollars to think how we can expedite the creation and operation of a comprehensive system of mental health care for kids in the state of Colorado that we don't currently have. The federal funds that are flowing to the state of Colorado under the ARPA are meant to inform and support the build of community infrastructure. There is no greater infrastructure need in the state right now as it pertains to youth than that with respect to mental health.
While COVID cases are on the decline, pediatric caregivers want the public to know that the pandemic is leaving behind a wake of traumatic stress in children that is not anywhere near over. And what they are seeing is a complex web of health problems that require more than vaccines to prevent. You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Around 15% of the trees on the Front Range are ash trees, and they're all at risk from emerald ash borer larvae currently turning into adult beetles that will emerge in May and June, ready to infest new ash trees. It's Emerald Ash Borer Awareness Week, and KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with two members of the Colorado Emerald Ash Borer Response Team about the current status of the EAB threat to Colorado's trees and the most recent guidance to address the growing problem.
My name is Lisa Mason, and I'm the horticulture agent for CSU Extension in Arapahoe County. An emerald ash borer is an invasive insect from Asia. In its native range in Asia, it has natural pests that keep the population under control. But it came via wood products to the United States back in 2002. And here in the United States, it doesn't have any of those natural pest controls. So it impacts all ash trees in the Fraxinus genus. And it's very deadly to all of our ash trees. It's a green metallic wood boring beetle, and it's spreading.
From what I understand, EAB was first detected in Colorado in 2013. What about other states? I haven't heard much about how other states and other parts of the U.S. are dealing with EAB.
My name is Dana Coelho. I am the Urban and Community Forestry Program Manager for the Colorado State Forest Service, which is also part of Colorado State University. The city of Denver organized some of their forestry professionals and city council members a few years ago to visit these cities and these places in the Midwest where EAB has done a number on their urban forests. So the type of strategies that are being used in other states, in other cities, and along the Front Range in Colorado, there's a few different options that we have. So proactive removals. If you have ash trees that are being damaged by something else, which is highly likely, there are lots of insects that love to munch on ash trees. So if we see unhealthy trees that would be more susceptible to EAB, a city or a homeowner can choose to remove those so that they don't become a host for a larger infestation. If we have healthy, large, mature, benefit-providing, shade-providing ash trees in our homes and on our local public lands, there are treatment options. So insecticides that can be used on those trees in a safe and professional manner to protect that tree from becoming infested with EAB. And then when we start talking about this longer term and full cycle urban forest management, if we're removing trees, we're pruning out damaged and dead parts of trees, being able to use that wood, whether it's for firewood that doesn't have little EABs in it, or wood products, biochar, there's lots of folks along the Front Range looking for markets to help pay for those really expensive removals and management activities of our urban forest and of our ash trees.
I'm curious what you would say to folks that might have one or multiple ash trees on their property and they're thinking, well, I really don't want to spend that $200, $250 to get my tree injected. You know, I don't want to deal with the hassle. I'm going to take my chances.
The cool thing about some of the insecticide products is if your tree already has emerald ash borer and the tree has not lost more than 30% of the tree canopy, you can actually have an arborist treat that tree after it's been infested with emerald ash borer.
This is Dana. So I think it's okay to wait. There's no reason to feel like you have to start investing in trunk injections if you are not in a known infested area.
Could one of you list those local areas where EAB has been identified?
So that's in and around the city of Boulder. In 2013, it spread in 2016 up to Longmont, 2017 into Lafayette, 2018 and 2019 into a little more of the Denver metro area and Broomfield and Adams County around Westminster. And then the most recent detections were in 2020. So last year in Louisville and in Arvada. The Colorado State Forest Service has a project called Your Ash is on the Line, because we are oh so clever in naming things. But that looks at the entire Front Range as a
at-risk area for the spread of this pest. And we're working on getting more of this type of, you know, private land and public land management options and management information out there so that people know what their options are and they know what they're looking for.
Let's talk a little bit about how to identify the presence of EAB, what to look for there.
So that's tough. Emerald ash borer is very tough to detect inside a tree, and it can be inside of a tree for years before you even notice. The classic sign is the D-shaped exit holes. Those usually start at the top of the tree, though.
And those holes are, like Lisa said, toward the top of the tree. They're also very tiny. Basically, if you can see the adult beetle, the adult borer, it's not EAB. They're incredibly, incredibly tiny insects.
The other signs and symptoms of emerald ash borer are that the tree is stressed out. So the canopy might start thinning. Sometimes it can shoot up epicormic shoots, which are basically branches with leaves that appear on the tree and in places they shouldn't. And use your county extension office as a local resource. If you have any tree, any sick tree or lawn troubles or insect questions, your local county extension office can help you with that. So look us up and give us a call or send us an email.
And our listeners can find that information on our website at news.kgnu.org, where we'll be posting links to those resources. Thank you both for joining me. I appreciate your time. For KGNU, I'm Hanalee Myers.
Time now for Make Them Hear You, a weekly commentary from Chris Moore.
Make Them Hear You.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. House Resolution 1603, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act of 2021, passed in the House 2 months ago and is now being considered in the Senate. Its official purpose is, quote, to amend the Immigration and Nationality Act to provide for terms and conditions for non-immigrant workers performing agricultural labor or services and for other purposes, close quote. This bill would create a path to legal status for undocumented farm workers. Almost every House Democrat voted in favor, but so did 30 Republicans. House sponsors Newhouse and Lofgren said the Senate must support it to create a steady labor pool for American farms. Quote, we've had a very hard year in America with the pandemic, but one of the things that has been a shining light is that the food supply was never disrupted, Lofgren said. The Farm Workforce Modernization Act does three major things. For starters, domestic farm workers can apply for temporary status as a, quote, certified agricultural worker if they've been in the fields at least 180 days in the past 2 years. These workers can then apply for a green card based on how long they've worked, then based on that, how much longer they'd have to work. They'd all have to go through background checks. Next, the H-2A guest worker program will be better organized for the filing process, cap wages, and expand the program to year-round industries like dairies and nurseries. Finally, the bill mandates e-verification for all farms. The bill has the support of over 300 organizations. Other groups oppose parts of it. The American Farm Bureau Federation says that, quote, we need guest worker visa reform, increased access to fill farm jobs, and a market-based wage rate that allows farmers to maintain economic viability, close quote. The Department of Homeland Security declared agriculture as, quote, critical infrastructure, close quote, during the pandemic year, but these workers have few protections. 73% of farm workers in this trillion-dollar industry were born outside of the U.S., The work is relentless, exhausting, and often dangerous. Under our current system, the majority of farmers are unable to find all the workers they need. If undocumented farm workers were all somehow deported, farm output would plummet by $60 billion a year. The temporary H-2A visas issued last year provided U.S. farms with less than 4% of workers that are needed for food production. Farmers complain that the H-2A system is both slow and expensive. Workers arrive an average of 22 days late, and if you need labor for year-round work in sectors like dairy or pork, you can't get the visas at all. If you have thoughts on the Farm Workforce Modernization Act of 2021, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And that does it for today's program. You've been listening to The Morning Magazine here on listener-sponsored community radio. I've been your host, Shannon Young. A reminder that if you'd like to share a comment with KGNU, call us at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25 during The Morning Magazine. Music heard during The Morning Magazine is by Poddington Bear and used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you have news tips for us, email us at news@kgnu.org.